This story highlights the importance of taking domestic violence seriously. Please be warned of the graphic nature of this episode because it may be triggering. And if you feel like you're in a situation similar, contact the domestic abuse hotline to get help. You can text BEGIN to 88788. Hi, I'm Ashley.
And I'm Ricky.
And this is Crime Salad, your weekly true crime podcast. Please subscribe wherever you're listening now.
Shots were fired from the outside into the house. And
do you know who it was?
Yeah, I got a great idea who it was.
Okay, are they still there?
I don't know. I left. I had to run.
He was shooting after me. The gunshot didn't hit anybody, correct?
No, they hit the back and glass shattered everywhere. They hit the sliding glass window. I think the shots were aimed at me.
The caller hid in fear, desperate for the police to arrive after the violent and unexpected gunshots were fired into the home where Amanda Cloninger Colley lived. The caller pleads for safety as you can hear gunshots. Fear seeps into every corner of the house. He has a handgun and he's shooting everybody. Mirabella is a master planned community in St. Johns County, just outside of St. Augustine, Florida.
So where is that? Is that like top, middle, bottom of Florida?
Well, it's near the top, so it's north, but it's close to the Atlantic Ocean. So you're getting the gorgeous beaches, and it's a popular spot for families because they have, you know, a friendly vibe, awesome schools, and tons of amenities. So Mirabella, it's a type of neighborhood that has everything from a community pool, a clubhouse, sports courts, like tennis courts, basketball courts, and walking trails. It's absolutely stunning.
Sounds nice.
Plus, it's close to really popular golf courses and shopping and restaurants, so you're never far from things to do. And being in St. Johns County is a big plus, too, since the area is known for having some of the best public schools in the region. However, on August 27th of 2015, in this upscale community, two women were tragically shot and killed inside of a home. This devastating event left five children motherless and forced two families to face an unimaginable reality of the loss of two people who should still be here today. 36-year-old Amanda Cloninger Colley and 39-year-old Lindy Dobbins.
Cases like this are so eye-opening because I'm 36 and you're only a couple years younger than I am.
Yeah. At the same time, Amanda never knew that this would actually happen. You see, this all unfolded in the kind of neighborhood where something like this feels non-existent. A meticulously planned community with pools, friendly neighbors always waving and smiling with perfectly manicured lawns. It's the sort of place you'd eagerly take your kids trick-or-treating, hoping to score those full-size candy bars. But behind the well-kept facade of the Colley home lay chaos and heartbreak. In August of 2015, Amanda's home had been ransacked. And when Amanda came home, she was in shock to see all of her belongings were destroyed. Knowing very well who did this and getting a bad feeling of what her soon-to-be ex-husband could be capable of if he destroyed all of her belongings. Amanda called up her two good friends who came over to support her, but they found themselves trapped in a nightmare as Amanda's soon-to-be ex-husband, J.R. Colley, was armed with a gun and fueled by rage, jealousy, and a desperate need for control. He aggressively made an entrance into her home, shattering a back glass door, and with the intention to end it all. Amanda Cloninger Colley was known for her outgoing nature. She was the life of the party, someone who brought warmth to all around her. She was adored by her friends for her beauty and confidence, and was described as a really nice person, someone who everyone wanted to be friends with. James Colley, who often went by JR, was a well-liked man in the banking industry, seemingly devoted to his children, coaching their sports teams, and engaging in family activities. He presents a perfect exterior, but inside were darker inclinations. And these started to be more apparent by people who knew him once he started to have a drinking problem. Amanda and JR had been married for 8 years, and over those years, they had two children. And Amanda, who was her bubbly, outgoing self, started to make JR jealous of her always wanting to hang out with her friends more and more. And with this and the mix of his drinking problem that started to become more apparent, his behavior started to have an effect on the family to the point where she reached her tipping point and she wanted to separate. There were times in the relationship where she wanted to make things work and he would try to be a great father to the kids, but there would be this other side of him. Amanda didn't want to just give it all up, but his behavior drove her to that point where she just wasn't happy. The separation papers were filed in mid-July of 2015, and Amanda stayed at the house where they previously shared, and JR went to live with his sister, who was 15 minutes away from where Amanda was living, which was in their marital home that the two once shared. He even got himself a girlfriend who he met at work, but would frequently visit Amanda, and it was brought up in court that this would be like an on and off situation. Maybe they kept trying to mend things together, but it seemed to only last a few days and then they would be back to fighting. Meanwhile, Amanda was trying to move on too. She met a guy who worked at the same company as her, but she was hesitant to tell JR, although he would continuously ask her who she was sleeping with, and she refused to admit it to him. Well, one night, JR, who was feeling suspicious, went over to Amanda's house, and this was a time when no one was home. He entered the home and gathered all of her clothes that were hanging up in her closet and burned them in the backyard. Now, after this incident, Amanda felt that this was the final straw. Hoping for peace, but mindful of JR's potential for volatility, Amanda files for divorce and filed a temporary injunction to protect herself from JR against domestic violence. And she knows what he is capable of because he had threatened her in the past. So in this injunction document, she wrote a note that read, "On numerous occasions, respondent has told me he would cut me up or kill me if he ever found out I was cheating."
It's crazy because he's obviously moving on, but he doesn't want her to do the same.
Yeah. And even though he persistently kept asking her who she was sleeping with and had a high suspicion, she was very hesitant to tell him because he threatened her. He threatened her life and her safety. And on top of that, like we said, JR was struggling with alcohol. And his friends even started to become more aware of this, even noticing his often disruptive behavior that tended to get worse when he was drinking.
Yeah, not a good mix.
No. And you would think with this protection order, it would put JR to a stop, but he had other plans, even recruiting the neighbors who were once his good friends to watch over Amanda. You know, keep an eye on her if anyone comes by the house or if anyone visits her, and report back to him.
Basically the neighborhood men.
Yeah. And so a friend and old neighbor of JR's spotted an unknown man shirtless mowing the lawn and snapped a photo of him and shared it with JR. JR messages Amanda, "I have a pic of him." She responds, "How do you have a pic of him? You don't even know what you're talking about." JR responds, "He isn't coming around for nothing, Amanda. Just stop lying. But I really feel like you could do better than that." She responded, "You caught me having someone mow the grass. Wow, I must be a whore." He said, "I don't want to fight. Can we just talk for a minute?" And she said, "No." JR sends a text to the neighbor who sent him the lawn boy photo and says, "She is an evil person. She is a cheating whore. She is the worst person on earth. Now she will pay."
And you are a hypocrite, JR.
Yeah. Basically, this sends JR into a violent spiral. Ultimately, he's getting angrier by the hour to the point where he's in a full bit of rage. And at 4:41 a.m. on August 27th, he's caught on a neighbor's surveillance camera driving into the cul-de-sac and parking in front of Amanda's house. This is when he sneaks into her home and realizes that Amanda's not there.
Which probably pissed him off more.
Yeah, like, where is she? She must be at that guy's house. So he enters the home, and as he's searching the home, he finds men's polo shirts. And looking further, he finds a collection of sex toys that were never used in their relationship. So this was confirmation to him that Amanda was seeing some other guy, even though JR had a girlfriend, and Amanda filed for divorce and also the protection order. And he wasn't allowed to be near Amanda or even inside the house at all. And so JR's suspicions were confirmed, and JR ransacked the entire house, destroying all of her belongings. The TVs were smashed. There were things thrown all over the place. There was trash dumped all over the floor. The furniture was damaged. The walls were damaged. It was just horrible.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, he's just losing complete control of himself.
Yeah. And so after he destroyed the inside of Amanda's house, he briefly went over to his friends who lived a few houses down from Amanda's house. Possibly this was the same friend who sent him that picture of the shirtless guy mowing her lawn. And he went over to his house to tell him what he discovered.
So he went over to his house at 4 or 5 in the morning?
Yeah. Can you imagine getting a knock on the door like, "Hey, I got something to tell you about Amanda over here."
Yeah, exactly.
I'd be like, "I'm sleeping. What are you doing?
Tell me tomorrow."
Yeah. Now, allegedly, that friend, he tried to calm him down. He even gave him a beer and told him, "Go home and get some rest." So he went back to his sister's home. And JR called Amanda multiple times. Most of those calls went unanswered. And by 9 a.m., Amanda returned back to her home, and she was completely shocked as to what she walked into. She had no idea that he did this, but had a good suspicion of who did this. She FaceTimed her boyfriend, Lamar Dauberly, to show him what JR had done. Lamar came over as soon as he could, and he called the police non-emergency line to report. A public service officer came to the house around 10 o'clock in the morning and took a report of the damages. However, Amanda didn't want to file any formal charges against JR until she spoke with her mother and attorney. And so there was nothing more for the officer to do, and they left. Now, two of Amanda's close friends, Lindy Dobbins and Rachel Hendricks, they also came over to Amanda's to give her support, as she was very upset that he would do this.
So where was JR at this point? Did he end up going home?
Well, I don't think he slept much. He eventually left his friend slash ex-neighbor's house. And around the same time Amanda was returning home, so around 9-ish in the morning, JR arrived at the courthouse for a hearing related to a different matter involving Amanda, a violation of his domestic violence injunction. And in the hearing video, JR appeared calm and cooperative. And during his exchange with the judge, JR, among other things, denied being under the influence of any substances. The judge allowed him to enter a no-contest plea to the charge.
So you said that he denied being under any type of substance?
Yeah.
So are we implying that he was?
Well, later in court, like whenever this all comes up in court, his defense team kind of pushes that he was, you know, on all these drugs and he was drinking and, you know, not right in the head. But here in court, he's like testifying, like, I am not under the influence of anything and I'm not on anything at all.
Right. And they continued. So obviously the judge was like, oh, he's fit for court.
Yeah. So JR, he left the courthouse just before 9:30 a.m. and he immediately began calling Amanda on his way to work. After several calls and voicemails, Amanda finally answered at 9:41 a.m. and they talked for roughly 14 minutes. After their call ended, JR stopped at a gas station near his sister's house, visited her home briefly, and then he returned back to the gas station where he bought a small amount of gas and other items. Evidence presented in court suggested that during this stop, JR picked up ammunition, though it was disputed whether he also collected firearms from his sister's house, or maybe these firearms were already in the car. Shortly after 10 a.m., JR began the 20-minute drive back toward Amanda's home. While en route, JR spoke with his father on the phone, and just so happened that a nearby dog walker overheard the call, must have heard it pretty clear as it stuck out to her, because she testified in court that the male's voice on the phone stated, quote, please, please, son, come back and get your truck. Everyone knows what you've been through. And this woman heard JR's response, I can't effing take this anymore. And I can't help but wonder the feeling she must have felt after knowing what he had done, hearing this, like firsthand.
One, it goes to show what type of neighborhood they were in, the fact that she even heard something like that and reported it. But two, yeah. It's like, imagine if she didn't hear it. You know, she's listening to Crime Salad on her earbuds, super loud.
Noise canceling,
right? It's crazy.
Yeah. Now, instead of driving directly to Amanda's, JR parked at an empty house on a nearby street. And from there, he crossed a berm and took a path running parallel to Amanda's fenced backyard. He was armed with two handguns, a 9mm and a .45 caliber. JR approached the back of Amanda's house and began shooting from outside, shooting at the glass back door, shattering through the house. Lamar, Amanda's boyfriend, shouted for everyone to run, and he escaped through the garage, but the three women ran to the master bedroom area where Amanda hid in the bathroom, and Lindy and Rachel took cover in a closet. And at 10:36 a.m., Amanda and Lindy separately called 911 from their cell phones. JR entered the house yelling, "Where is he? Where is he?" as he stepped through the shattered glass doors that he shot. He first came across Amanda, who was in the bathroom, shouting at her and demanding to know where he was. Amanda begged him to put down the gun and insisted she didn't know. JR then attempted to open the closet door, but Rachel braced it shut with her foot. Through tears, Amanda told JR that only Rachel and Lindy were inside, to which Lindy called out, "It's Lindy in here. It's Lindy." JR returned to the bathroom and shot Amanda. Later, this was determined by a medical examiner that this shot wasn't fatal. He then went back to the closet, unable to open the door again. JR fired a shot through the door, grazing Rachel's arm and forcing her to release her hold on the door. And Rachel Hendricks made a run for it to a neighbor's house where she called 911. As for Amanda and Lindy, they were still inside, gunned down by JR, who entered the closet, walked over to where Lindy was crouched, hiding behind a chest, and shot her, killing her.
Wow.
Amanda was still in the bathroom, so JR went back there, shot her three more times until his 9mm was out of bullets. He dropped the 9mm and shot Amanda five more times using the 45. And then after that, he left the home. He went back to his sister's house on Garrison Drive, leaving his cell phone behind at his sister's house, and fled the area. Police officers arrested JR hours later after a traffic stop in Northern Virginia, about a 9-hour drive, almost 600 miles away just before 10 p.m., from where he murdered two people.
I think one thing that gets me here is the fact that he brought two pistols with him. It's almost like he anticipated the fact that he may need more bullets.
Yeah.
Right? Like, he wasn't going to leave without completing the job.
Killing everybody in the house.
Anybody, everything, definitely her.
Yeah.
And the fact that he dropped the 9mm pistol to continue with the other one is just crazy to me.
Yeah, it's like personal. Like, she's already dead and you shoot her five more times.
It's awful.
What gets me is these two women, they were mothers. Like, so five kids in total, they don't even have a mother anymore.
Yeah. And one of them had nothing to do with it.
Yeah. And even Amanda's kids, they don't have a mother or a father.
Right. And if Rachel didn't escape, she would have been dead too.
Mm-hmm. And just think about it. This happened in 2015. So years of grief the family of Amanda and Lindy had to endure until this went to trial, which was 3 years later in July of 2018. That's just got to be so hard for families to just sit there and just wait for justice. Now, like you said, Rachel, she made it out alive. Lamar, the boyfriend, made it out alive. However, Amanda and Lindy were essentially trapped in a room, helpless, and were made aware that they were going to die. He even shoots Amanda once. She's not immediately dead. He left her there, knowing she was injured enough to not try to escape. She felt pain, and she lied there helpless as she was cowering in fear while he shot her best friend, Lindy Dobbins, killing her. Then he went back to shoot her three more times using a 9mm, dropping the gun because it was out of bullets, and uses the 45 caliber to shoot her five more times.
Oh, so he didn't drop the gun, pick up the other one, and go after the friend. He literally unloaded the pistol that he had and then picked up his other one to make sure Amanda was dead.
Either make sure or just personally, like, just shoot her, like, out of anger.
Right, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it's similar to the cases where someone gets stabbed 200 times, right? Yeah. Where it could have been five.
But yeah, I mean, this kind of seems like this was all intentional. Now, when they get to court, it was described that the court found J.R. Cawley's arguments unconvincing.
What did the defense argue?
So the defense, they argued that the state had not proven premeditation. And they also pushed their theory that he was on an emotional roller coaster and didn't have any intentions to kill anyone when he went inside the house carrying two guns, and that this was all just a snap reaction.
I mean, what about the fact he brought two guns with him?
Yeah. It's kind of a reach, really, but... Now, there were testimonies from witnesses that came forward and also the medical examiner who indicated that both Amanda and Lindy were terrified during the attack. Cawley's actions showed intent and prolonged suffering for his victims, especially as both were cornered and aware of their fate. the court concluded that the circumstances went beyond an ordinary murder, demonstrating extreme cruelty and emotional torment for both women before their deaths. JR's defense team shared his version of events on the morning of the murders. He said he had been drinking and using cocaine the night before he trashed Amanda's house. Amanda and JR spoke early that morning, and he offered to cover the damages, with Amanda agreeing not to press charges. JR Colley said that he took one or two Ambien pills around 5 in the morning, and he woke up later by his father around 9 o'clock to remind him to go to his court hearing. And after court, he stopped at a gas station, visited his sister, and he headed to Amanda's house, claiming that he first approached the house unarmed, but what triggered him was seeing a man inside of the house caused him to panic. He went back to the car, grabbed the guns, and carried out the killings. Now, Dr. Mark Mills, a forensic psychiatrist, suggested Colley was heavily affected by an Ambien side effect called parasomnia, a sleep disorder where a person seems alert but later has no memory of their actions. Dr. Mills's opinion was based on Colley's snapshot memories of the day of the murders, recalling only flashes. Another doctor, a clinical neuropsychologist, testified about Colley's mental health, noting depression, anxiety, panic attacks, and his self-medication with alcohol. However, she didn't specifically address impairment. Lastly, another doctor, a pharmacologist, supported Dr. Mills's opinion, explaining how Colley's medications could have contributed to his impaired state at the time of the murders.
Honestly, though, impaired or not, you killed two people with the intentions to kill more, but they escaped.
Yeah.
It would be different if he was mentally ill or something. If you're drinking alcohol, doing cocaine, and you took some sleeping pills.
Yeah, on top of that, Amanda was receiving threats from this guy. Like, I will kill you.
Yeah.
If I catch you with some other guy, even though he was moving on and even though they were separating.
I understand they're trying to say that this isn't premeditated and it was like a reaction. But the fact is, what, the day before or the morning of, whatever, he came in and destroyed the place, caught stuff on fire. What would have happened if she was there then?
Yeah, it's like he was waiting for her to be there, and those two times she wasn't.
Right. So how is that not premeditated?
Yeah. Now, there were two of JR's sisters who testified that he had a supportive, close-knit family growing up, where he developed a strong work ethic and kept steady employment. They described him as a dedicated, hands-on dad to his two kids, involved in volunteer work and mentorship. However, they noted he struggled with alcohol abuse for years. One sister recalled he had witnessed two domestic violence incidents between his parents as a child. Other family members, including two cousins and a brother-in-law, shared that Colley was a good father, a good uncle. A neighbor mentioned his involvement in the community, coaching his son's football team and baseball teams. A friend and two former coworkers described Colley as a family-oriented person and a loyal friend. To counter the idea that Colley was impaired during the murders, the state brought in two witnesses, Dr. Jeffrey Danziger, a forensic psychiatrist, and Judge Charles Tinlin, who had overseen Colley's court hearing the morning of the murder. So if you remember, the morning of the murders, Colley went to court for that protection order situation, domestic violence situation that he had with Amanda.
Oh, right. And he deemed him fit for court. This is that part.
Yes. Now, Dr. Danziger explained that parasomnia involves unusual behaviors during sleep, but he clarified that side effects from Ambien, like parasomnia, are rare. He also said that when people experience parasomnia, they generally appear dazed, disoriented, and uncoordinated, none of which matched Colley's behavior on the day of the murders. Dr. Danziger based his opinion on several observations. Colley acted normal up to the murders, was logical and clear-minded at the courthouse just an hour before, and had no memory gaps when discussing the murders 3 months later with a psychologist.
So bam, the defense team is shaking in their boots now. They're like, now what do we come up with?
Yeah, exactly. Now, Judge Tinlin confirmed he had no concerns about Colley being impaired during the hearing. Colley was responsive. He asked relevant questions and appeared alert and composed. The state also showed video footage from the hearing where Colley was seen answering questions clearly, testifying about his job and his education, and even confirming he wasn't under the influence. Throughout, Colley asked specific questions about his probation and fees, indicating that he was fully present and attentive.
So, I have a question. Obviously, he killed two people, you know, on drugs or not, impaired, whatever. Is it just like a lesser sentence or something like that? I guess the reason I'm asking is, think of it this way. You have vehicular homicide. And if you're a drunk driver, no one gives a shit. You know, you killed somebody and you get charged. So is the defense team only pushing this for a lighter sentence, or like, what is this?
I'm assuming so, you know, a lesser sentence, because the jury actually, they end up agreeing on the death penalty being an appropriate fit for him.
Oh, okay.
Cool. So it's like a fight to just, you know, let's get a lesser sentence. Let's try to, you know, avoid the death penalty if we can.
Right. So it's a lesser charge thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, the evidence at trial supported that J.R. Colley retrieved ammunition during his brief stop at his sister's house. The two guns that he used were actually registered under her name. However, the parties disputed whether he also retrieved the guns there or were the guns already in the car that he was driving. His sister testified that the guns were already in the car. She kept them there for protection.
Oh, so the guns were in the sister's name, not Amanda's name.
Yeah. At some point, he got the guns either from his sister's house or they were just in her car. But with all this ammunition, however, his sister was like, those guns were in my car. I mean, I have them in there for my protection. Like, I don't know.
Right, right. So could he even own a gun, being that he had a restraining order?
Well, that's a good question. How does someone face a domestic abuse injunction and have access to firearms? Well, experts highlight the limitations of legal protections and the severe risk that victims face when leaving violent partners. There's a former state's attorney's office executive, Rich Commando, who notes that injunctions are just a piece of paper and really only of value when respected by those they target. Ellen Seiler, an executive director of Hubbard House, which is a shelter for domestic violence survivors, expressed both sadness and frustration, calling the tragedy sadly familiar. She emphasized that leaving a violent relationship is a vulnerable time, urging victims to avoid places known to their abusers.
I think that's easier said than done, right? This is something where you're naive to the fact. I mean, there were, what, four people in that house?
Mm-hmm.
None of them thought he could show up with a gun. I'm sure they thought maybe he would show up and cause some trouble.
Yeah.
None of them thought, oh, he's coming in the house to kill us.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. It's like a tough call because you never know what someone's really capable of or what they're thinking at the time. Or now, the judge who granted the injunction against James Colley, or JR, to protect his wife, reported disturbing incidents. For one, her clothes were burned, her medication was stolen, and there were threats made against her. The injunction barred James Colley from possessing any firearms, but it was pointed out that this enforcement often relies on an unreliable honor system, as police typically don't confiscate weapons when issuing restraining orders. Rich Commando acknowledged the civil rights challenges in confiscating firearms, but also noted that violence can still occur through other means, like vehicles or knives. And former state's attorney Harry Shorstein observed that injunctions can only deter individuals who are rational and stable. In the case of someone determined to harm, a legal document may not be enough. And he urged victims to seek refuge at a shelter and consider safer alternatives that their abuser might not anticipate.
Again, easier said than done.
And as it was mentioned in court, this leaves domestic violence advocates and legal professionals questioning the sufficiency of current laws in protecting victims.
Right.
There's also a change.org petition called Lindy and Amanda's Law that's pushing for tougher rules to protect people facing domestic violence. This demands stricter enforcement of restraining orders and tougher penalties for anyone breaking them. And it highlights how, in cases like James Colley's, ignoring a restraining order shows a complete disregard for the law. The petition argues that even one night in jail could have changed the outcome for Amanda, giving him time to think about the impact on his children and everyone around him. On July 18th of 2018, the jury found James T. Colley Jr. guilty on all counts. He was convicted of the first-degree murder of both Amanda Cloninger Colley and Lindy Dobbins, attempted murder of Lamar Dauberly, and attempted felony murder of Rachel Hendricks. He was also charged with breaking into homes, one involving assault and aggravated stalking, even after a court order to stay away. The jury found that four aggravating factors applied to both of Colley's murder convictions. They determined that Colley had previous violent felony convictions, the murders and attempted murders themselves. Each murder happened during a burglary. Both murders were carried out in a particularly brutal and cruel way, and he committed each murder in a cold, calculated, and premeditated way with no moral or legal justification. For Amanda's murder, they added a fifth factor. James Colley was under a domestic violence injunction, and Amanda was the one who had filed it against him. After reviewing these factors along with any possible mitigating circumstances, the jury unanimously recommended that Colley receive the death penalty for each murder.
Good.
And the court also heard from James Colley himself, stating, "This was a horrible, terrible accident, and I wish it was different, but it's not. And I'm sorry for all parties involved." The defense submitted various letters from friends and family. The court held a sentencing hearing on November 30th of 2018, and it confirmed that the state had proven all five aggravating factors for Amanda Colley's murder and all four for Lindy Dobbins' murder, beyond a reasonable doubt. Additionally, the defense presented evidence for 23 mitigating factors, which the court found credible. However, the court ultimately concluded that the aggravating factors significantly outweighed the mitigating circumstances in the case. So, if that doesn't make sense to you, the aggravating factors, these might include elements like premeditation, extreme cruelty, or harm to multiple victims, things that suggest the crime was especially serious or committed with significant intent. Mitigating circumstances could involve factors like the defendant's mental state, lack of prior criminal record, or evidence of remorse, which might provide context or lessen the perceived severity of the crime.
Okay, good. Because I kind of got that, but I got a really small brain.
You don't. Basically, they're saying what he did is pretty severe compared to his mental state or anything else. Now, as for the survivors in this story, Rachel Hendricks and Lamar Dauberly, who both testified in court their emotional story, Rachel described JR's unhinged behavior in detail, even recounting the fear and the chaos inside of Amanda's home. And Lamar shared that he was targeted by James, and he explained in detail his desperate escape and survival. Even other witnesses came forward describing James's escalating threats, and they painted a picture of his violent intentions. Lindy's husband testified in court with tears as he explained how there's an empty seat saved for Lindy at their son's Little League baseball games so she can watch her son play. And there were shirts made for their daughter's swim team, remembering Lindy. You can see how heartbroken he is with Lindy's loss, knowing that his two children will have to navigate life without their mother, all because of James Colley's actions. The St. Augustine community was deeply impacted by this tragedy as well, which illustrates the devastating scars left by domestic violence, which leads us to close this episode highlighting the importance of taking domestic violence seriously. Although protective measures like injunctions are crucial, they are often limited without broader support systems. So if you or maybe you know someone who is in a domestic violence situation, it's best to get a hold of the domestic abuse hotline where they can help guide you to the necessary steps for your safety. We will leave their contact information in the description for you. And as we end this episode, please take care of yourself. As always, make sure you subscribe to Crime Salad so you don't miss our latest episodes, and tell a friend about Crime Salad. If you're interested in becoming a subscriber for as little as a dollar, you can get uninterrupted ad-free episodes.
And honestly, now would be a great time because we just changed networks. We probably aren't going to have a ton of ads for at least a month. And donations help.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for supporting our show. And we will see you next time.